The story is told of a grandfather who was talking to his grandson. He said, "Grandson, there are two wolves living in my heart. And they are at war with each other, these wolves. One is vicious, one wolf is vicious and cruel, and the other is wise and kind." "Grandfather," the grandson said, "which one will win?" The grandfather paused and then he said, "The one I feed. The one I feed." Choices. The choices we make in life feed the appetites of our souls. Our character is the sum of our choices in life. And tough choices prove our character. We will be tested. You have been tested, I'm sure, in life. And the tests of life determine who we are, and our choices determine what we will become. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." 1 Samuel chapter 20, as we pick up our story this morning, story of David and Jonathan. 1 Samuel 20 is all about choices, the choices that Jonathan makes in times of challenge and controversy. There are four basic choices in this chapter that prove our character in life. First of all, will we choose between conflicting loyalties? Verses 1 through 11. 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 1. "Then David fled from Naioth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, 'What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life?' And he said to him, 'Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so.' Yet David vowed again, saying, 'Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight.' And he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death.' Then Jonathan said to David, 'Whatever you say, I will do for you.' So David said to Jonathan, 'Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king. But let me go that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family. If he says it is good, your servant shall be safe. But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself, for why then should you bring me to your father?' And Jonathan said, 'Far be it from you, for if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it?' Then David said to Jonathan, 'Who will tell me if your father answers you harshly?' And Jonathan said to David, 'Come, and let us go out into the field.' So both of them went out into the field." I think this is one of the hardest choices we face in life. We're caught between conflicting loyalties, and we're forced to make a choice between those loyalties. Which one is the higher loyalty? Which loyalty is the higher priority? Both are good. Both are important. Which one is more important? I don't know about you, but I don't like those kinds of choices. I don't like being put in the middle, do you? Between conflicting loyalties, where I want to be loyal to both sides. I don't like being put in that position, and I'm sure you neither do you, in terms of friends or by circumstances or situations. And so We often avoid making that kind of choice. We don't want to choose between conflicting loyalties. Well, Jonathan is caught between conflicting loyalties here. He wants to be loyal to his father, King Saul, but he has promised his loyalty to David. They have established a covenant with one another. He wants to support his father, but he knows that God has chosen David to be the next king. He is caught between God's choice and family loyalty. He wants desperately to believe that his father would never do the evil that David is accusing his father of planning to do. Now you remember the story from last Sunday. David has fled from Saul because Saul tried to kill him with a spear. He fled to Samuel at Naioth. Saul pursued David to Naioth, and God miraculously delivers David there. David then runs back to the palace to see his friend Jonathan. He asks Jonathan, "What have I done that your father wants to kill me? What have I done that's wrong? I've done nothing wrong. I've kept my word. I've kept my word to you, Jonathan. I've kept my word to your father. I've been loyal. I've done my job. Why does he want to kill me? What have I done that I'm hunted down like an animal?" Jonathan responds by defending his dad. He denies that his father would kill David despite all of the evidence to the contrary. He cannot bring himself to consider the idea that his dad would murder David, his best friend. Jonathan wants desperately to believe his father, to take him at his word. You remember back in chapter 19, verse 6, that Jonathan asked his father, and his father's promise that he would not kill David. So he wants desperately to take his father at his word. It's a tough spot for Jonathan, isn't it? Conflicting loyalties, his loyalty to David, his loyalty to his father. David's blunt. He sees what Jonathan cannot see. Saul would never confide in Jonathan about this because Saul knows that or senses that Jonathan is loyal to David. So he's not going to talk to Jonathan about this. And David's life is truly in danger. And Jonathan is being naive to believe his father. So Jonathan must make a choice here. He's caught in the middle. And so they set up a test. Really more for Jonathan's sake than David's, I think. David is pretty certain that Saul is out to kill him. I mean, when somebody throws a spear at you multiple times, you sort of get that feeling, don't you? But Jonathan needs to see it for himself. So the coming new moon feast is a good chance to test this out. Jonathan can see his father's true character for himself. Will he choose between the conflicting loyalties? Now back in chapter 18, David and Jonathan made a covenant. It is the foundation for this whole story here. They made a covenant with each other, and that covenant is mentioned numerous times, mentioned here in this passage. David refers to the covenant here. He says that he has not sinned against King Saul, and he offers to let Jonathan kill him. Go ahead, kill me if I've violated my vow to you, Jonathan. If I have failed in any way, just kill me now. What is the nature of this covenant? We're never actually told. It doesn't actually say the covenant when they make it. But from here and later in this chapter, we can discern several elements from this covenant. First of all, David has promised that he will not take the kingdom by force. He will protect Jonathan's family, and he will not take the kingdom by force. He will let Saul be. And Jonathan, in turn, has promised that he will support David as the next king of Israel. So Jonathan and David both promise to each other some things in this covenant. And both are going to be held to those promises. Now, do you remember our working definition of integrity? I've used Stephen Carter's definition. Yale University professor wrote a book on integrity. I think it's an excellent book, by the way. And in that book, he defined or described integrity as requiring three elements, and then goes on to apply it in the political realm and in the business world and all of these other areas. Element number one, integrity requires discerning what is right from wrong in any situation. You have to be able to discern that. Number two, acting on what we have discerned to be right, even at personal cost. And number three, saying openly that we are acting on what we believe to be right as opposed to what is wrong. Now, one of the big tests of integrity is whether we will act on what is right even at personal cost, you see. That's the big test of integrity. Will we act on what we know is right even if it costs us in the business world, in the church, in the whatever realm we're in, all right? Will we act on it even though it costs us something? Jonathan and David both pass the test in this chapter, the test of integrity. David will keep his word to Jonathan, even though it means that he must run away into exile. He will not take the kingdom by force. Will not. He'll keep his word even at personal cost. Jonathan, I think, is even a greater hero in this passage. Jonathan will keep his word to David, even though it means that he must choose to protect David against his own father and incur his father's anger in that process. So this is our test too in life, isn't it? Wherever you are often tested in these same ways. Will we pass the integrity test? Will we do what is right, even at personal cost? Will we make a choice between conflicting loyalties to do what is right in this situation? Allison tells about being tested in this way as a college freshman in an English exam. Every time she answered a question, she felt like somebody was watching a little too closely. So she turned her head and she glanced back and she saw Joel looking over her head, over her shoulder at her paper. He gave her a wink and he whispered, "I hope you studied for this test." She gave him kind of a wary smile, not sure if he was joking or not, and returned to her test. But she leaned a little more closely to her exam paper. And she heard him whisper, "I can't see." Now, Allison was a Christian, and she believed that cheating was wrong. But Joel was her friend, a close friend. What was she going to do? She thought to herself, she had to do what was right. But just like in the movies, she said, it seemed like the mini angel and the mini devil were on each shoulder. He's your friend. What are friends for? You got to be loyal to him and help him out. But it's wrong. I can't do that. But he'll think you're a snob and your friendship will be ruined. And back and forth, the battle raged in her head. But she knew she had to do what was right. So for the rest of the test, she carefully guarded her paper. And when she completed her test and got up and turned around, she faced the icy glare of her friend Joel. She said if looks could kill, her parents would have been planning her funeral that afternoon. She knew that cheating was wrong, but she didn't want to destroy her friendship, so she said to him, "Sorry, Joel, but you know me well enough to know how I feel about cheating. But maybe I could help you study before the next test." Joel's expression softened and he said, "Okay, Allison,
I'll give it a try.
Will we choose between conflicting loyalties in the small things and the big things of life? That's the first choice that divides. Secondly, will we trust God's future plans at the expense of our present success? Verse 12. Jonathan wants to go and talk some more, and he knows that the palace is not a healthy place to talk, so they go out to the field. Verse 12, then Jonathan said to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if there is a good feeling toward David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also if I do not make it known to you and send you away that you may go in safety. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. And if I am still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? And you shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies." And Jonathan made David vow again. See, this is the repeat of the vow. Because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. Then Jonathan said to him, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. When you have stayed for 3 days, you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself on that eventful day, and you shall remain by the stone of Etzel. And I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target. And behold, I will send the lad, saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I specifically say to the lad, 'Behold, the arrows are on this side of you, get them, then come, for there is safety for you and no harm as the Lord lives.' But if I say to the youth, 'Behold, the arrows are beyond you, go, for the Lord has sent you away. As for the agreement of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever.'" Our covenant is a forever covenant. Now, we have just seen David's fear. David is afraid that he's going to be killed by Saul. That's a reasonable fear, isn't it? He's had some experience with this. The irony of this passage is that Jonathan is afraid, but he's not afraid that David's going to die. Why? Because he knows that God has promised that David will be the next king. Jonathan has more faith in God's promise than David does at this point. Jonathan's not afraid David's going to die. He assumes that David will be protected, and he says, "When God has wiped out all your enemies," that would include my dad, David, if that's the case, "when God has wiped out all your enemies, remember our covenant and protect my family." See, Jonathan's not worried about David's death. Jonathan's worried about what? He's worried about his family when this is all over. Jonathan assumes David will be saved, and he wants David to recommit, and it's to covenant again, to promise again, that when he comes to power, he will take care of Jonathan's family. He assumes that David will be king. That's the irony here, that Jonathan is afraid for his own family, even as David flees for his life. Now, once he has that commitment then from David, he sets up the procedure of getting word to David about the outcome of the test. David's to hide in the field near this rock, and Jonathan will shoot some arrows, and depending upon the instructions, David will know whether he can come out of hiding or he must run away. But all of that is based on the fact that Jonathan trusts in God's plan for David, even more than David does at this point. He doesn't doubt that God will fulfill his promises to David. The present for David may look very bleak, but the future is secure, and Jonathan, even more than David, will stake his hope on God's future plan at the expense of their present success. Now, that is by definition what faith is all about. It's staking our hope on the future plan of God, even if it means we give up on our present success. That's Jonathan's faith here. Will we trust his plan? Are we able to sacrifice our short-term goals for his long-term plan? Life looks bad right now, but God has a plan for you. Things look bleak right now, but God has a future for you. Do you believe that? Can you trust him for that? Even at the expense of your present success. That's a choice we all must make at times in life, isn't it? That's a choice of faith. That's a faith choice. Success in our jobs is not as important as God's plan for our lives. Success this year is not as important as investing in what God wants to accomplish in the years ahead through us and in us and by us and for us. Material prosperity is not as important as God's kingdom goals. Can you hope and trust in God's future plan even though it looks like a mess right now? And can you choose to follow that plan even at the expense of the present in your life? That's faith. In September 2007, the issue of today's Christian, Shirley Shaw tells the story of how the sacrifices of a successful cabinet maker named Terry Lane continue to change a drug-riddled neighborhood in Jacksonville, Florida. In 1985, Terry Lane built a 25,000-square-foot, state-of-the-art cabinet-making plant called Midlane Corporation. Almost immediately, trouble started. Broken windows, shots fired, bullet holes in the walls, stolen equipment, vandalism, including cars in their parking lot set on fire. It was a horrendous situation. It turns out he had built his plant right next door to The Rock, which was an apartment complex of 200 or 300 apartments that was known throughout Jacksonville as the headquarters for crack cocaine and felons, and even the police didn't like to go into The Rock. What was he going to do? Day after day, week after week, he faced this kind of challenge. Terry thought about it. He decided that God wanted him there, and he decided to reach out to the children of this neighborhood. It started by inscribing some basketballs with "God loves you" and "Terry Lane loves you" and throwing them over the fence. He said the good sign was they didn't come back. Then one day he was working by himself in the plant on a Saturday at his drafting board, and he went outside for a break, and there were some kids playing there in the parking lot, and he invited them to come in and have some sodas, and he opened up the soda machine, and he gave them all free sodas. So the next Monday, he was in his office, and his secretary called him to come out. 16 kids had come into the plant, into the entrance there, and they were looking for the guy who gives out free sodas. And that was the start. He began ministering to the kids of The Rock, the children, after school. They had no place to go. Over time, he ministered to more and more of the kids until oftentimes in the afternoons as he sat at his drafting board, there were kids all throughout his office drinking sodas and talking. And soon his work with the kids began to take more and more of his time. 10 years after he first reached out to the kids of The Rock, he sold out his share of his cabinet-making business to his partner. He started a ministry that eventually became a community center called Metro Kids Connection. He moved into the apartment complex and established this community center, where the staff today feeds over 145 children, physically, yes, but also academically and spiritually, in the name of Christ. Shaw ends her article with these final thoughts from Terry. There is so much to do, but I'm excited and grateful for the direction God chose for me. My wife and I have gone from enjoying a six-figure annual income to subsisting on $12,000 a year. But God faithfully meets every need, and the rewards are incomparable. He's staking his life on the future hope of God's kingdom. Will we trust God's future plan at the expense of our present success? Jonathan does. Third principle, will we stand up for right when others pursue wrong? Verse 24. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food, and the king sat on his seat as usual, the seat by the wall. Then Jonathan rose up, and Abner sat down by Saul's side. But David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, for he thought, it is an accident. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. Ceremonial cleanliness. He would have had to have done that in order to participate in the feast. And it came about the next day, the second day of the new moon, that David's place was empty. And now you wouldn't be ceremonially clean, unclean for 2 days. So that raises the question. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal either yesterday or today? Jonathan then answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem, for he said, please let me go, since our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to attend. And now if I have found favor in your sight, please let me get away that I may see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan. He said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. I guess it's his mother's fault. Do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore, now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die. But Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put David to death. Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. The plan that David and Jonathan hatched is set in motion. It's the new moon festival when Israelite families gathered together to celebrate this feast together. It was a 3-day feast. David, of course, would be expected to attend the feast at Saul's home, at his palace, because he's Saul's son-in-law. Now, it's ironic that, to me at least, that Saul would expect him to attend after trying to kill him. But apparently Saul expected him to be there. And as we picture the event, Saul's seated against the wall with Abner by his side. Jonathan is seated across the hall from his father. David would normally have been seated next to Jonathan, but of course his place is empty. And Jonathan sets up the test that he and David have concocted together. He embellishes the lie that they have concocted together by adding that David's brother commanded him to attend the family feast in Bethlehem. Now, this is a lie. I mean, obviously David's not in Bethlehem. He's in the field out there hiding. This is a bald-faced lie. So I'm not suggesting they passed the integrity test with this one. All right? They concocted this lie. Jonathan adds to the lie. Morally, David and Jonathan are wrong for doing this, for lying to Saul. The lie doesn't work anyway. This is the big problem with lies most of the time anyway, is they never work, at least not long term, because sooner or later they're found out here, sooner more than later. If anything, this whole lie made matters worse. They would have been better off not lying in the first place. Saul sees through it all immediately. He lashes out at Jonathan for being part of the whole scheme. He unleashes a torrent of insults at Jonathan, intended to humiliate him for bringing shame on the family, not being loyal. That was a big thing in Eastern culture, to be loyal to your family. So Jonathan now has a choice to make. He can choose to be silent and let his father go on about David. He can back down before his father's anger. Many a son would do that. He can allow his father to continue unimpeded with his plans to murder David. Or he can stand up to his father and speak out in defense of David and correct his father for his sinful behavior. Well, Jonathan decides to stand up against what is wrong and to stand for right. And he speaks out against his father. He's open and he's honest now about his allegiance. That's what he should have done in the first place. That's what David and Jonathan should have done in the first place. Now they do it, or Jonathan does it. Deceit has not worked. He will stand strong now. This is wrong. You are doing wrong, Dad. I will defend David. He's done nothing wrong to you. And Saul, of course, does the unthinkable. He grabs his spear. He tries to kill his own son. That's proof enough, isn't it? Jonathan knows, of course, that the game is up. And he will stand with David against his own father in this matter. He'll not hide his allegiance any longer. And sometimes in life, we have to stand up for what is right when others, even kings, even parents, even family members are planning to do wrong. Have we got the courage and the integrity to stand up for right, even when others pursue wrong? Based on a true story of an army commander in Vietnam, We Were Soldiers tells of Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore, who led his troops into one of the bloodiest battles in the Vietnam War. Moore is a Christian, a great leader and an American hero, by the way. He was recently honored at West Point for his service to America. At the beginning of the movie then, and the movie is based upon the true story, at the beginning of the movie, Moore gives a stirring speech to his troops, promising his commitment to them, his absolute commitment, his dedication to sacrificial leadership. And with great seriousness, he says these words: "Let us understand the situation. We are going into battle against a tough and determined enemy. I can't promise you that I'll bring you all home alive, but this I swear before you and before Almighty God, that when we go into battle, I will be the first to set foot on the field, the last to step off, and I will leave no one behind. Dead or alive, we will all come home together, so help me God." Great speech, great promise. Not long after, they're on the battlefield. Army headquarters realizes that they've made a serious mistake. They have seriously underestimated the firepower of the enemy in this situation. The enemy is too strong for them. And as the fire intensifies and it eliminates all air support for these soldiers, the officers back at the base decide to send in one last helicopter to evacuate Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore and him only. We'll get our leader out of there and we'll let the rest of them die. That's the decision of Army headquarters. When headquarters radios the orders for Moore to take his last helicopter back from the front line, he's outraged. He grabs the radio and he barks into it, "I am in a fight. I object to this order. I will not leave my men." And he slams the phone down and he stays with his men. And he ends the firefight by taking his remaining men on a daring charge deeper into enemy territory that turns the tide of the battle, leads to a dramatic victory for the American forces. There's the question, isn't it? Will we stand for right, even at personal cost, and even when others in power over us command us to do wrong? That's the third question that we face in this chapter. Fourth, will our love hold us together when others drive us apart? Verse 35. Now it came about in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field for the appointment with David, and a little lad was with him. And he said to his lad, "Run, find now the arrows which I am about to shoot." As the lad was running, he shot an arrow past him. When the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" And Jonathan called after the lad, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay." Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow, came to his master, but the lad was not aware of anything, only Jonathan and David knew about the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, "Go, bring them to the city." When the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed each other and wept together, but David more. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'" Then he rose and departed, while Jonathan went into the city. So David spent the night hiding in the fields outside of Gibeah. The next morning, Jonathan brings his helper with him, shoots the arrows, tells the boy to retrieve them, uses the code words. David knows he's got to run for his life. The signals have been sent. But Jonathan doesn't want to say goodbye that way, does he? So he sends the boy with his weapons back into town. And he waits for David to come out of hiding. And the farewell here is one of the most beautiful, I think, and most poignant stories in all of the Bible. Because David and Jonathan will see each other only one more time in their lives. These two who have committed themselves to each other absolutely, in brotherly love, we'll see each other one more time in the 10 years ahead. As David runs for his life as a fugitive, and Jonathan serves his father in the army and for the country, they will only see each other once more. Yet Jonathan will never, ever give up on his friendship with David. And David will never, ever give up on his friendship with Jonathan, to the point that even after Jonathan is dead and David is king, he will remain loyal to Jonathan's family and take care of his family. But that's getting way ahead of the story. That kind of commitment, that kind of loyal love that unites two people even when they are being driven apart by the circumstances and the people in their lives. The opening verse of the next chapter tells us that David runs to the city of Nob near Jerusalem. He will never break his covenant with Jonathan. Jonathan will not break his covenant with David. Here we have, I think, the classic description of true friendship in all of Scripture. A recent USA Today article portrayed vividly the courage of that kind of true friendship. Ann Helle and Debbie Nichols were friends who were mountain biking on a wilderness trail in California when a 110-pound mountain lion sprang from the brush, pounced on Ann's back, and dragged her off by the head into the brush. Debbie Nichols screamed for help. She grabbed Ann's legs, trying to free her, and she engaged in a desperate tug-of-war with the mountain lion for her friend. Other cyclists got involved and began throwing rocks at the lion until it finally fled. Jackie Van Workum said she was riding behind Ann and Debbie and later spoke to Debbie at the hospital. She had some blood on her face. She definitely showed signs of major struggle, Van Workum said. She was shaking. She was trembling. She said, "I was not going to let go. I was not going to let go." Legs. The mountain lion had the head of Ann pulling the other way. Nichols described the tenacity of the cat, saying this guy would not let go. He had hold of her face, but the tenacity of the cat was overcome by the faithfulness of a friend who would not let go. She said, "I just told Ann, I will not let go. I will never let go. I won't let you go." And she was saved. Now, do you have a friend like that? You're blessed if you do. Are you a friend like that? That's a Jonathan kind of friend, a David kind of friend. That's true friendship. That's what the Bible calls brotherly love. Life may fall apart. Everything may be messed up. But a friend says, "I will not let you go. I'm not going to let go. I'm going to stand for you. I'm going to hold on to you." And if you have that kind of friendship, folks, you are blessed by God. For that is brotherly love. Taekwondo star Esther Kim, age 20, going to the Sydney Olympics had been a lifelong dream. She came very close to embracing that dream at the Olympic trials, where she was scheduled to fight her best friend, K-Po. They'd been best friends since childhood. K-Po was ranked number one in the world, but Po had injured her knee in the semifinals match and could hardly stand up for the finals match with her best friend. Obviously, Kim could have easily defeated Po, but she believed that that kind of a matchup was hardly fair. In an instant, she decided to forfeit the match, automatically sending K-Po to the Olympics and ending her chances for her Olympic dream. The moment she made her decision, Kim knew it was right. I thought, it's not like I'm going to be throwing my dream away. I'm just going to be handing it over to Kay. Kay's generosity was affirmed when she was given the Citizenship Through Sports Award, which recognizes exemplary citizenship, sportsmanship, ethical conduct, and community service. In addition, the International Olympic Committee agreed to pay for her and her father to go to the Sydney Olympics that year. But people still criticized her decision. You're supposed to stand for number one in this world. This was your chance, your Olympic dream. You had worked all your life for this. How could you forfeit and give it up? Kim says, even though I didn't have the gold medal around me, for the first time in my life, I was a real champion. Be a real champion for Christ. Father, teach us. Help us. These are tough tests, often ones we don't want to face in life. They are choices that often divide. They are choices that are very, very difficult. And the only way we can do it is by faith in you to see us through. I pray that you will help us to make the choices you want us to make, even if it costs us, as we follow you in life. In Jesus' name, amen. Hymn number